From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. If you had $1.50 in your wallet, what could you do with it? A cup of coffee, maybe? Or how about a 10-year lease on a whole acre of beautiful, prime, taxpayer-owned wilderness in, say, Montana, Nevada, Utah, or elsewhere in the United States? Well, you could. The Trump administration is offering up parcels of public land to the oil and gas business, and some of it ends up at bargain basement prices. Why all of this supply and so little demand right now? That's where the story gets complicated, but we'll explore. This hour on Point, public lands and the energy business now. And you can join us. Where do you stand on leasing public lands to the energy industry? If it means energy independence for this country, are you on board? Are you in the energy sector or live near some of these national lands and monuments? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Well, joining us first today from Spokane, Washington is Carl Sagerstrom. He's a contributing editor at High Country News. He covers public lands, energy, and communities in the Pacific Northwest, the Northern Rockies, and Alaska. Carl, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
First of all, I was just wondering if you could lay the groundwork here about how these auctions or leases for public lands work. How much thus far has the Trump administration, you know, put up for auction?
So one of the big differences in the Trump administration is how much acreage is being offered, not necessarily how much is being sold. So in 2008 or 2017, they offered 11.8 million acres. And they actually only sold a little bit more than 1.1 million, but that big discrepancy between how much is offered and how much is sold is kind of a new development with the Trump administration.
Okay. So now let's talk a little bit about how we are getting some of these sales, and we'll explore exactly what sales mean, at this $2 or $1.50 per acre price. What's going on there? How does the whole system work?
Okay, so basically it's dictated by the Mineral Leasing Act of 1920, which kind of compels the Interior Department to lease public lands for oil and gas drilling. And the basic process of the leasing is there's a nomination by an oil and gas company, and then the BLM office will do the environmental planning documents. And once those are finalized, there will be an auction. And if no one bids at the auction, then you can buy the lands the next day at the non-competitive rate, and that's where you get the $1.50 for an acre of public land.
But if an energy company is identifying the parcels, why wouldn't anyone bid on it?
That's a great question. There's a fair amount of speculation on these public lands, and in some cases, expressions of interest are not done in good faith. There's some instances like in Nevada where there's very little oil and natural gas exploration. 300,000 acres were put up for nomination and there were zero bids. So it's kind of a situation where this is an embarrassment to the oil industry in some corners. There's a great article in the Nevada Independent about a senator, a top oil industry lobbyist, and an environmentalist all agree on one thing, and that's that these lease sales make the whole system look bad because they waste the BLM's time. They just make the oil and gas industry look like speculators, and they put public land on the auction block with no real intent of developing it.
Oh, interesting. Because the oil and gas industry is looking for more opportunities in places where they believe there are known reserves or more likely to be reserves?
Yeah. So there's kind of both ends of the spectrum. There's public lands that go for $1.50, and there's public land for $1.50 an acre, and there's public lands that go for over $80,000 an acre in oil-rich areas. So a lot of those cheaper public lands are bought up by a few different companies that are more in the speculation game, and some of that has to do with potential helium assets. So that's kind of there's kind of two different sides to the story in terms of who's interested in buying these public lands and what their eventual plans might be.
Well, so let me just ask you a little bit more about the practicalities of how this works, right? Because we are talking about vast, you know, vast tracts of America's public land here. When, you know, when the leases are sold, whether it's for the $1.50 or $2 or all the way up to the $80,000 you're talking about, what does that mean for the public's access to those lands? Does it mean that it's you know, just blocked off for 10 years and that no one else can access it while the energy companies have control of it?
Technically, there's supposed to be maintenance of public access, but when oil and gas industry starts ramping up production, those will be kind of work sites where, one, I don't think a lot of recreationalists want to go, you know, go mountain biking or go for a run or go for a hike around oil and gas drilling rigs. But it's supposed to – public access is supposed to stay maintained, but they do kind of take on a industrial appearance on the land.
Okay. Now, Carl, we should explore the fact that the Trump administration has been calling for American energy dominance, right? And so this is one of the moves of the Interior Department and the BLM, as you're talking about, to sort of fast track or make more lands available for energy exploration in order to achieve that dominance and independence. So has the administration, in fact, been successful in those efforts?
I think you could argue they've been successful in ramping up production on public lands, but they haven't by loosening some of the restrictions on industries operating on public lands, such as when it comes to methane or other kind of operational concerns with oil and gas. But in terms of actual land leased, it's an uptick from 2015 and 2016, but it's not more than the kind of the running average between 1988 and 2016. So there's not a huge push for more. There isn't more volume, but where these leases are is becoming more controversial. And then just the existence of this program in light of kind of increased awareness around climate change is becoming more controversial.
Okay, so many interesting questions around that. Where are some of the controversial leases then? Give me a couple examples.
Okay, a couple examples are some recent leases in Wyoming in an area called the Golden Triangle, which has the highest sage grouse concentration. And sage grouse are kind of this enigmatic bird of the West and a kind of an icon of the sagebrush plateau and also an indicator species of the health of the entire habitat. There is a huge kind of conservation agreement to keep them off the endangered species list that has recently been rewritten by the Trump administration. So that previously protected area under that 2015 plan was recently leased.
Okay. Go ahead.
And then some other places that kind of have generated controversy are proposed drilling near Chaco Canyon and proposed drilling near the Sand Dunes National Park in Colorado. So these kind of areas that are valued for their cultural or their tourism industry values.
You know, we've already got some questions here coming in online from folks who were kind of wondering what the big deal is. For example, Jeff here on our website says, why don't some of our environmental public interest groups bid for rights and then keep the petroleum and gas in the ground? Are there requirements for obtaining leases that they couldn't qualify for?
Yes, there are. Then people have gone to jail for falsely bidding on oil and gas leases. Since there used to be a lot of public protests, they've moved the system to an online system that have kind of taken away the ability of your everyday citizen to raise their hand and say, I want these public lands. But there are famous cases of environmentalists trying to buy public lands and because they've been shown not to be good faith oil and gas developers, going to jail for falsely bidding.
So you have to be in the industry in order to legally bid on these. Okay.
Yeah. These lands are being sold for oil and gas exploration, not just to anyone.
Okay. Carl, let me ask you then. Let's take a step back here. I mean, some folks might be wondering, What's the big deal? I mean, if we have some of these parcels, yes, being leased off at remarkably low rates for a 10-year deal, but there's no development or no actual drilling being done on some of them. And as you were saying earlier, the rules say, at least on paper, that the public should have some access to those lands, even if they're under a lease agreement. Like what's the big deal? What's the problem?
Well, I think the problem depends on your perspective. I know that for some people it has to do with destruction of habitat. So, wildlife corridor. So, if a oil and gas rig is near an wildlife corridor, it might make it might hamper the migration of an animal like mule deer, which are huge migratory animals in Wyoming. There's also the questions of how the federal government should be participating in priming the pump for oil and gas industries in the face of a changing climate, in the face of kind of a movement away from fossil fuels in some sectors. There's a lot of there's also kind of methane is another big issue with public oil and gas drilling, methane being 86 times more, having more climate warming effects than carbon dioxide right. over a 20-year period.
So. And this is methane that gets burned off in the drilling and production process.
Yeah, or leaks out.
Okay. Well, Carl Sagerstrom in Spokane, Washington. Carl is the contributing editor at High Country News. Hang on here for just a second, Carl. We got to take a quick break. We are talking about the fact that over the past couple of years, the oil and gas industry has access to some of America's public lands at as low as $1.50 or $2 per acre, and why that's happening, and especially now given the overall energy market in the United States and around the world. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about America's public lands and the energy business now. And that's because for the past couple of years, the Trump administration has made available vast tracts of public lands for oil and gas exploration. And due to some complex but very interesting reasons, some of that acreage is going for leasing for 10-year leases as low as $1.50 or $2 per acre to these energy companies. We're joined today by Carl Sagerstrom. He's the contributing editor at High Country News. He covers public lands, energy, and communities in the Pacific Northwest, Northern Rockies, and Alaska. And he's with us from Spokane, Washington today. And joining us now, in addition, is Amy Myers Jaffe. She's with us from Westport, Connecticut. She's director of the Program on Energy Security and Climate Change at the Council on Foreign Relations. She also writes the blog Energy Real Politics that delves into the underlying forces shaping global energy markets. Amy Myers Jaffe, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna. Thanks for having me.
So first of all, I mean, Carl has sort of laid out this interesting dynamic that we have about why some of the acreage that the Trump administration is putting up for auction is going at such low prices. What does that tell us about the current state of the energy markets right now? Because I think a common presumption might be that this is very valuable land because there's the constant demand for oil and gas. So what's going on in the markets?
Well, you know, not all oil and gas land is equal. And to give you a comparison, an acre of land in the Permian Basin in Texas is going for $100,000. So that is sort of a data point because there's so much oil and gas that's possible to be recovered in a very short period of time in the Permian that that's in a very attractive place for all kinds of investors, big and large, from ExxonMobil down to, you know, some small private equity firm that like to get in on a play for pension funds. When you look across the West, then you have a lot of variation. There were a lot of companies that really wanted to drill in an area called the Powder River Basin.
Mm-hmm.
And there, the acreage is going for about $10,000 an acre. And you see the sort of household names for fracking like Chesapeake or Devon or EOG are doing well there. But again, by comparison, in the Permian, we're talking millions of barrels a day. You know, in the Powder River Basin, they've gone up from 80,000 barrels a day now during the Trump administration to about 125,000 barrels a day. And they're only expected to get to 200,000 barrels a day, say, by 2023.
Right.
So we're not talking about the same volume
mm-hmm.
of oil and gas, but to a smaller company, you know, any volume is helpful,
yeah.
Especially if you're carrying some debt.
Well, Amy, let me just jump in here. The Permian Basin, what, Texas and the Southwest United States, one of the most
correct.
Prolific oil and gas basins in the country. Is that right?
That is correct. That is where most of the action is. That is the action that's upsetting the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries and forcing Saudi Arabia to reevaluate its long-term strategies. Most of that is coming from Texas and, to a lesser extent, New Mexico and Louisiana. But for the most part, this southern Texas play, the Permian Basin, I'm sorry, West Texas play, the Permian Basin, and then the Eagle Ford, which is in South Texas, is really where we're going to get this push where the United States is going to become no longer a net importer of oil.
Okay. So, but I'm still trying to, I'm grappling with what I feel is a pretty basic question. And maybe it's just because, you know, these are complex markets here. But Carl told us earlier that the parcels that are going up for auction are identified by members of the industry themselves, right? And then it goes through the approval process through BLM, et cetera. Why are they identifying parcels that maybe no one is necessarily interested in? I'm not. What's the point here? Why is this happening?
Well, you know, like any field, you know, there are people who are good at things and people who are not good at things. So not all oil companies are equal. And as we saw in the downturn in 2014, there were companies that sought acreage to do fracking. And it turned out it wasn't very productive acreage, or it was too expensive to do it there. And so they lost a lot of money. Some of them went bankrupt. Whereas there are other companies that were in better areas that, you know, didn't have the same difficulties when the oil price came way down. So you have two things. You have, you know, what's immediate now and what is the price of oil today? And then, you know, you might have a lot of optimism that 10 years from now, the price of oil will be a lot higher, or 5 years, the price of oil will be a lot higher. You might be trying to diversify yourself. You might think that there's a technology you're working on today, and if it's available in 5 years, this acreage that you can now get for a dollar might be worth $10. Or maybe
mm-hmm.
you're just investing. I've seen this happen. You're sort of an oil company created by financial players, and you believe that you're going to buy this land lease for cheap, and then you're going to flip it to somebody else.
Okay.
And in the early days of fracking, you know, people became billionaires doing that. But it's not clear whether that's going to be able to happen going forward.
Okay. But Carl was telling us earlier that it may have reached the point now where even members of the industry are saying that the Trump administration is kind of making a mockery of the process. And Amy, I mean, I'm just wondering, like, is the oil and gas industry, are they concerned about being seen, about the public perception of, like, maybe once again they're engaging in this, I don't know, land grab, the speculative land grab of public lands that have a much better use for perhaps current day use for, you know, environmental and climate reasons?
Well, I have to say, I tend to, when I'm speaking to groups that involve people from the oil industry, talk about what I call the backlash effect. So to the extent that you wake up in the morning in the United States and you start to believe increasingly across the public space that somehow the oil industry has captured the regulator. And that could go to the BLM, that can go to a state regulation, that can go to the EPA, Environmental Protection Agency. You know, to the extent that I believe that the oil industry is controlling all these agencies or that these agencies are no longer doing their role to protect the public or to protect the environment, then you see the public come out in very dramatic ways. So in the state of Colorado, for example, last year there was a referendum during midterms to create a restriction for how close an oil and gas company could drill to a building or a park.
Mm-hmm.
And that was significant because if it had passed, you know, something like 80% of all future drilling in the state would have become illegal. And you would imagine in an oil state like Colorado, you know, how many people in an urban area were going to vote for that bill. But actually, the bill got 43% of the vote, so it almost passed. And indeed, this past year, the last couple of months, the Trump administration wanted to open up development to an area called the North Fork Valley. And, we mentioned before on the show this, you know, very popular bird of the region, the sage grouse, and also, you know, deer and other kinds of wildlife. And even the governor of the state pushed back.
Mm-hmm.
And said, no, we need to have a moratorium. We don't like the fast-track processes that have been created by this new Trump administration policy.
Right.
And we in Colorado, we want to slow down.
Yeah.
And that was a very popular step.
Well, so Amy,
by the governor.
Yeah, Amy, hang on here for just a second, because I want to turn back to Carl. Carl, you're there in Spokane, Washington. You've been covering this for a long time. Couple of questions for you. One, picking up on what Amy Myers Jaffe was just saying. Have you been seeing an increased pushback or reaction to some of these leases as people figure out that the parcels have been sold off?
I think it definitely depends on where you are and
right.
how dependent an area is on oil and gas jobs and how oil and gas development conflicts with the kind of way of life in a certain area. I know that the North Fork Valley that she was talking to is actually where High Country News Paonia headquarters is. And there was a lot of local pushback to development. It's a region that's got a booming agricultural economy and agritourism economy. And it's just it's definitely one of those lease sales that is in an area where the local kind of politics aren't in favor of continued or more oil and gas exploration.
Okay. I want to talk more about the fast track processes in just a second. But, you know, we have a lot of callers who actually want to join us here. So let's go to them. Jeanette is calling from Warren, Illinois. Jeanette, you're on the air.
Hi there. I am a seasonal employee, long time with the National Park Service. I spent about 15 years all over the West. And definitely revisiting Theodore Roosevelt with oil leases outside of the park and more recently is a big difference. And visiting Carlsbad National Park this winter to go volunteer.
Mm-hmm.
My husband, who had lived in New Mexico 15 years ago, could see a dramatic, huge difference in the Permian Basin. And definitely he could say that, yeah, when we found out, you know, trying to go find camping places on BLM, there's a lot of areas that are close to the public. Hello?
Hi, yeah, Jeanette, go ahead. We still have you.
Oh, yes. There are a lot of differences with the development, lower air quality, much higher costs for housing, the boom and bust industry, boom and bust makes it much harder for regular employees who aren't high dollar folks to find housing.
Yeah. Well, Jeanette, your line's getting a bit shaky here, and I don't want to lose you mid sentence. But thank you so much for your call, Carl Sagerstrom. You know how Jeanette mentioned she was worried. She was talking about some potential environmental impacts in communities around where some of these land sales have happened. We've got a comment here from Mad Mark, the Code Warrior, who says, how would you feel if your water comes from an aquifer running under these federal lands? If you're a rancher or farmer, there can be toxic runoff in the streams and bodies of water that you really rely on for your livestock and even your personal use. Mark there pointing out to the techniques that they use for drilling that can potentially pump toxins into the groundwater. I mean, how much of these environmental concerns are we seeing in surrounding communities?
I think there's huge environmental concerns. I mean, we've seen that play out a lot in Wyoming with conflicts between the oil and gas industry and the ranching industry and polluted aquifers and polluted water sources. I know that was a huge part of the concern in the North Fork Valley leases, which are currently kind of on hold after judge found that they didn't significantly address the wildlife and climate change potential of those oil and gas leases.
Mm. Let's go to Kyle, who's calling from West Glover, Vermont. Kyle, you're on the air.
Hello, everyone. I was thinking about this, and you mentioned 100,000 acres in Nevada. Perhaps they don't offer a lot of a natural potential for the fossil fuel industry. But I'm wondering, it might be very advantageous to have renewables there, like particularly solar. So I'm wondering if that is on the table, and if not, why?
Yeah, Kyle, great question. Amy Myers Jaffe, let me turn to you for that. Can the definition of who's qualified to bid on these lands be expanded to renewables?
Well, I mean, the U.S. government does have some leasing for renewables. In particular, there's a lot of fanfare when they did the first leases for offshore wind. So it is possible to lease federal land for renewables. I do not believe that the Trump administration is looking at that for some of these western onshore areas, but could be something, you know, that makes a difference in the private sector. When you're talking private lands, you do get a lot of conflict, local conflict between ranchers or farmers that are willing to lease their land for, say, wind development or solar development, and those that don't like the impact of that on the landscape or birdscape. So,
well, you say the Trump administration likely wouldn't consider it, but should they?
Oh, 100%. I mean, I think that and I can't speak to whether, you know, it's very, actually, there are particular specifications that companies look for to do solar farms. So I can't speak to whether the areas that they're leasing for oil and gas would be appropriate for solar or not. I've never looked at that personally. But what I would say is that on a state-by-state level, at the midterm elections, we saw a lot of governors get swept in promising to try to push those states to 100% renewable energy. That's a very popular thing in the United States. I think it's put the Republican Party under a lot of pressure coming into the presidential election cycle. You see a lot of new talk in Congress on the Republican side about how they too would like to have, you know, climate regulation, and they are supporting clean energy. And so you have this sort of negative clean energy message coming out of the White House. The president was literally mocking wind at a rally this week. When, you know, even in places like Texas, you know, wind is incredibly popular. It's providing a lot of revenue and jobs and real electricity. And we are making headway on backup systems, storage, and other kinds of systems to sort of handle the intermittency problem.
Well, you know, one of our listeners, Nelson Law, though, says, so what? We need oil and natural gas to build and maintain a modern economy and country. Wind and solar have received a large amount of federal funds but can't provide 24/7, 365 power. Amy, we've just got a minute to go before we have to take a break, but what would you say to Nelson Law?
What I would say to Nelson Law is that all the drilling for oil and gas that is on, you know, these lands and gets an intangible drilling credit, which is the same thing. They get a tax credit. which is exactly what renewables get, a tax credit. So there's really no distinction made between the two.
Okay. Well, Amy Myers Jaffe, Director of the Program on Energy Security and Climate Change at the Council on Foreign Relations, and Carl Sagerstrom, Contributing Editor at High Country News. Hang on for a moment, because we are talking this hour about public lands and the energy business now, and the fact that the Trump administration, in its efforts to maintain or create American energy dominance, has opened up vast tracts of public lands to oil and energy industry leases, which means some of that land is going for as low as $1.50 per acre. What do you think about it? We'll be back. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about America's public lands and the energy business now, and how vast tracts of that public land are being offered up for leases in auctions to the energy industry. And in fact, there might be a glut of that land, because we're seeing some of these auctions end up in prices as low as $1.50 or $2 per acre. It's a complex set of reasons why that's happening, and joining us this hour to help us sort through it is Carl Sagerstrom. He's contributing editor at High Country News. He's with us from Spokane, Washington. Amy Myers Jaffe is also with us from Westport, Connecticut. She's director of the Program on Energy Security and Climate Change at the Council on Foreign Relations. Carl, we got a very good but simple question that's come in online here from someone calling themselves Chicken Little, who basically asks, how is this different than Obama? So how is what the Trump administration is doing regarding these public land leases different than what was happening under the Obama administration?
Well, there's several ways that it's different. The kind of the biggest like number off the top is how many acres were offered, but the amount of acres offered ended up not being the amount of acres sold. So under the Obama administration, between 2008 and 2014, they were actually selling more acreage than the Trump administration has yet on a per year basis. The things that have changed are mostly kind of on the back end of oil and gas drilling, and that's there has been efforts to shorten the amount of protest and public comment periods that were put in place by the Trump administration, and those have since been thrown out in court. There's been an uptick in protests, and that kind of has followed a recent trend with kind of the keep it in the ground movement of more protests on these oil and gas leases. And then there's also been there's been rollback of potential rules that would have kind of tried to limit some of the emissions, especially methane, and also just kind of put in stronger safeguards for operating on oil and gas, oil and gas on public lands.
So you've mentioned methane a couple of times here, and we should talk about the potential climate impacts from the oil and gas exploration that's being done on these public lands here. I mean, seeing Timothy Egan wrote in the New York Times, he says that almost 25% of American climate emissions originate from industrial action involving public land or offshore leases. But there's been a couple of court cases recently that may be requiring the Interior Department or the BLM to take a closer look at what the climate impacts could be when they put these parcels up for lease?
Exactly. They are making them take a closer look and disclose that information on the potential climate impacts of oil and gas leasing on public lands. But under kind of the laws that dictate environmental management and federal environmental policy acts, there's no laws that are going to make them change the way that they do their operations. They're just – the judges are telling them that you need to be upfront with the potential climate change impacts of this oil and gas exploration, or coal exploration for that matter.
Hmm. Amy Myers Jaffe, what do you think about the needing to look at the climate impacts?
Well, I think the interesting thing, and that really is a difference between the Obama administration and the Trump administration. The Obama administration was moving towards, first of all, completely restricting methane release from federal lands, and moving towards new wells, but moving towards better standards for existing wells. The interesting thing is because the Trump administration has moved in the opposite direction. And let me add, I think partly because they have to offer something to the oil and gas industry because the trade wars that the administration has pursued, saying that it was going to help the oil and gas industry has actually done the opposite. It's been much harder today for producers of natural gas to create projects to sell natural gas abroad, especially to China, given the trade war. And we saw actually a period of time where China cut all purchases of U.S. crude oil exports because of the trade war. So, and then we had the, you know, dicey back and forth in the trade deal with Mexico. So, you know, in the end, I can't say that the oil industry, you know, as we're talking in this program, it sounds like we're giving the message that the Trump administration has been a great boon for the oil industry, and they're all popping corks at the, you know, opportunity to pollute. But actually, the administration has done some things that have been pretty deleterious or harmful for the businesses that are trying to increase oil and gas production in the United States and export it. So it's been a mixed bag. And then on the methane leakage, we know, which is, as you say, methane is a very potent greenhouse gas, and therefore we really do need to have a strong policy on methane leakage. And, you know, there are other things that sometimes leak out at the same time that can cause acid rain in certain locations. So, you know, it does affect more than just the climate. There is this new thing that's happening, which is that because we don't have a regulatory focus in the United States, pension funds and others that are shareholders of all these oil and gas companies are starting to make demands that these companies capture and reprocess their methane. And they're making headway. And so the interesting thing is you've got even big oil companies like, you know, ExxonMobil or BP, you know, declaring to the public that they'd like federal restrictions on methane leakage. So that comes from the pressure from their own shareholders and from concerns over their stock price on the New York Stock Exchange.
But was it Exxon that just recently won an effort to block a climate change resolution that came from some activist shareholders?
They did. They said that they did not want to allow the shareholders to tell them exactly what their methane leakage target should be, that would be interfering too much in Exxon's businesses. But let me tell you, the companies that have accepted the shareholder resolutions and work with shareholders, BP, Shell, Total, and more recently Chevron to some extent, are seeing their stock perform better than Exxon. So I think that, you know, with all due respect to Exxon and their approach, I think that they're hurting the value of their company by taking, not sort of rolling along with, you know, where their shareholders are going and feeling and with the trends of risk that are coming. And, you know, companies operate and sell not just in the United States. You know, one of the mistakes the Trump administration is making, in my opinion, is that if you're going to be exporting U.S. oil and gas, and you have a lot of methane leakage in the United States, you could get some kind of border adjustment for that oil and gas in Europe or China or some other place that's part of the Paris Accord. So, you know, it's a global market.
Yeah. Well, let's go back to our callers. Let's go to Janet, who's calling from Somerville, South Carolina. Janet, you're on the air.
So I'm Dr. Beau Hack with Care Energy, and we have a feedstock that takes CO2 and transforms it into food, fuel, and feed. If I could get my public land for $1.50 an acre, it's a huge subsidy, and it makes biofuels not competitive to oil when they get subsidized like this. And I'd have investors lining up to build biofuel plants if we could get public lands for this kind of money.
Yeah.
It makes it really uncompetitive for the renewables.
Janet, thank you so much for your call. Carl Sagerstrom, let me turn back to you here. I mean, we touched on this a little bit earlier in the show, but is there an opportunity, if the Trump administration wanted it, to really, through public lands, shape future energy markets and maybe, you know, turn us more towards biofuels, as Janet was saying, or renewables?
Yeah, I think there's great opportunity. And there was definitely a push under the Obama administration to kind of diversify the public lands energy portfolio with more, especially more solar. I think an important thing to recognize is kind of the role of legislation and laws and kind of setting the table, because this oil and gas leasing is happening under a law from 1920, the Mineral Leasing Act. And that was at a time when renewable energy wasn't a conversation and climate change wasn't a conversation. So the agencies are acting within kind of the framework of the laws that are on the books, but the laws that are on the books don't consider climate change or renewable energy.
Okay. So Amy Myers Jaffe, though, I mean, is the market itself changing regardless, right? Because we have several states in the United States, one of them most recently California, right, which is just basically like a small country by itself, that have passed resolutions to pursue 100% renewable energy mandates for 100% renewable energy and similar efforts globally. So regardless of maybe what the Trump administration itself wants to do, are these oil and gas companies looking at a future market that's completely different?
Well, and you're seeing some oil companies respond to that. One of the things that's interesting about this big land leasing activity in the West is that when you produce oil, you get a lot of associated natural gas, and then some of these lands, they're going to only have natural gas. And back in the day, before California announced they were going to 100% renewables, many oil companies that operated in Colorado and in this play called the Niobrara play that runs through the West were expecting to produce that natural gas and sell it to California. Well, California is probably not going to be taking that gas. So you have some stranded resource where you've got people who have the acreage or own the acreage or had a production plan, and the question is, where is all that natural gas going to go? So that's question number one. The second question really is going to be, you know, how do technologies change? So here in the Northeast, whether it's Vermont or New York or others, they are finding that going to these renewable energy assets actually can lower electricity costs because the costs of solar have come down so substantially. And the question is, how do we deploy, you know, battery storage or other kinds of backup systems that make it, you know, not only reliable but not one of the things that's happened is it's so cheap to do solar, it's making a problem for the economics of nuclear, for example. And so you get these anomalies where what we call the baseload power, the big plants, whether that's a coal plant or a nuclear plant, are not able to make the returns, and so they're shutting down. And you're having more renewables, which is a great thing, but to keep system stability, you know, it's going to take some planning as to where the renewables are put in versus other locations. Yeah. And that is something that the regulator is starting to work on.
Let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Tim, who's calling from Columbia, South Carolina. Tim, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. Yes, I have a quick. The industries like oil, gas, lumber have been taking advantage of the lease program for a very long time. I like to see the federal government and state's government go to maybe a profit sharing instead of leasing the land. Let them make a profit. Let the government take a piece of the action.
Tim, thank you for your call. Carl Sagerstrom, does anything like that already exist?
Yeah, so half of the oil and gas lease goes to the state that it's located in. So there is revenue sharing between the states where oil and gas drilling occurs and the federal government.
So revenue sharing in terms of the revenue pulled out of the ground, not just the price of the lease itself.
So the price of the lease itself and then royalties after the fact.
And then royalties after.
If it's developed.
Okay. So maybe something like that already exists. Interesting. Let's go back to the phone. One more call here. Ben is calling from Stevens Point, Wisconsin. Ben, you're on the air.
Hi. One quick comment. One of the things that doesn't get as much value as I think it should is ecosystem benefits and also habitat. If this land is being leased for a dollar something, what does that say that we're valuing that land for? We're not putting, you know, a dollar amount of value on habitat for endangered species or any species. or productive ecosystem services like cleaning water, creating oxygen. We're not putting a higher value on those things as I think we should.
Yeah. Ben, thank you for your call. And Carl, I'm going to turn back to you because this is one of the perennial fundamental questions about how we view natural resources in America, right? Whether we view them through the lens of what we can extract from the land or the overall benefit that that land provides in terms of ecosystems, as Ben was saying, recreation, pollution, or reducing pollution, things like that. I mean, what does this story about how we're leasing off public lands right now tell you about, how the country views the fundamental value of its, 500 million acres that we have out there?
Yeah, I think there's a real disconnect between the way that the agency is behaving right now and those values. They've made no bones about their goals of energy dominance, and they've rescinded or walked back or shelved many rules or reports that kind of fly in the face of or that question the value of that kind of industry dominance or the eventual impact. So I think in the pursuit of American energy dominance, a lot of those other values that other people might see on the land have definitely taken a backseat.
Mm. Well, Amy Myers Jaffe, we just have a minute left to go here. A lot of these leases they're 10-year leases, so perhaps the energy markets could change. And, you know, for the ones that are lying fallow right now, we'll see drilling in the near future. Who knows? But do you think that the administration should continue to be offering up so much public land for the industry to take its leases on?
You know, I think the industry has actually plenty of land to drill on, and I think it's a public policy question. When we go into the next election cycle, I think the public does need to think about, as climate change happens, water supplies become scarcer in different parts of the country, and we have other kinds of threats to ecosystems and food supply. We're going to have to think thoughtfully about what are the trade-offs between driving a car that runs on gasoline and having the price be low and these other commodities and ecosystem things that we need, that we're going to need for our future. And I think you're going to see more and more debate of that in the political domain.
Well, Amy Myers Jaffe with us from Westport, Connecticut. She's director of the Program on Energy Security and Climate Change at the Council on Foreign Relations. Thank you so much, Amy.
Thank you very much for having me.
And Carl Sagerstrom with us from Spokane, Washington, contributing editor at High Country News. Carl, it was great to have you. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.